Hello and welcome to another edition of MSU Today. Today, our first guest is Ron Hendrick. Dr. Hendrick is the Dean of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources here at Michigan State University. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning. Appreciate you having me.
So could you just start out by telling our listeners a little bit about what a dean of a College of Agriculture and Natural Resources does, and how it is that you came to this position?
I made kind of a circuitous route back to the university, Bill. I did my bachelor's and PhD degrees here, and I left in 1992. I did a postdoctoral fellowship in Alaska, and then I went to Georgia for 16 years there, and that's where I spent most of my active faculty career, and migrated back a little bit north to the Ohio State University for about 7.5 years, and then came back here in the summer of 2016 as dean. So again, kind of a circuitous route back, but it's been, you know, an interesting and exciting time. Our college does a lot of different things you would expect, of course, related to food, but the environment as well. But, you know, I have everything from interior designers to soil microbiologists on my faculty and everything in between. And so my responsibility really is to empower my leaders at many levels in order to do the teaching, the research, and the outreach missions. We're a little different than other colleges because we're also the home for MSU Extension and our statewide presence there, and then also Ag Bio Research, which is our agricultural experiment station as Michigan's land-grant university. And then I think, as you know, we have a very big international footprint as well, and are literally on every continent and in many parts around the world, and have remained that way here through the pandemic as well.
How has the pandemic affected the college? At Michigan State, so many of our units have been working largely remotely. A College of Agriculture and Natural Resources has many, just by way of example, many animals that are part of our work out on the farms. And you know, when you look at, it's actually interesting when you look at the university's footprint, probably 2/3 or better of that footprint belongs to your college, and people don't realize how far south our property actually extends, and on that property are horses and cows and multiple variations of chickens and other fowl. And so how has the pandemic impacted your operations?
Yeah, well, thanks. We do have a very big footprint. I think we are definitely the university's biggest tenant in terms of acres occupied. You know, the governor's executive order initially came out, there were exemptions for things related to food and fiber production, including research. So we had both the fortune and the big lift of getting our research adapted to this new operating environment. And, you know, one of the things, as you mentioned, that couldn't go interrupted at all was the care for all the things that we have custodial responsibility for. And so I think, you know, all of us, we've been focused on the two-legged, right? It's about keeping ourselves and our colleagues and our students healthy and those around us. But, you know, I've got a lot of four-legged critters, and you know, I have entomology. So I have 6 legs and 8 legs and 100 legs and, you know, fisheries and wildlife. And so there's fins and feathers and furs, and all those things require care. Some require more than others. Some it's sort of a feeding and watering and looking after basic medical care. But at our dairy facility, those cows need to be milked every day, and now we're milking them twice a day. And so, you know, much credit to my staff and the staff leaders, as well as faculty and my administrators, for keeping all those things going. And we've been remarkably uninterrupted, but it was a very big lift early on getting things going. You know, when we moved to remote work in late March, we were right on the cusp of the start of the growing season. So crops and other things need to go out, and not just ours to support our work, but our stakeholders. You know, we're a very agriculturally diverse state. And so we are working with our partners and on farms and with them and in their facilities year-round, but particularly during the growing season. You know, we can't let insects or disease problems, you know, that might decimate an important food crop, for example, get out ahead of us. And we're always on the outlook for, you know, animal and wildlife diseases and other sort of things. So it was a very big lift, but with the help of the university and senior leadership and my folks within the college, I think we've done a remarkably good job.
Well, I think that's always one of the really interesting aspects of Michigan State University that maybe isn't quite so obvious, is that, you know, when we have a snow day, there are a lot of people for whom a snow day isn't an option. You know, we have a police department, we run an on-campus hotel, we have, you know, typically 15,000 students living in the residence halls that need to be fed every day. And then we have, as you say, cows to be milked and other animals to be fed and taken care of. And it really is a 365 day a year, I was going to say job. It's less a job than sort of a calling, I think, when you're committed to the sort of Noah's Ark of animals that make up the college. But one thing you said, I thought it was an important point to emphasize and maybe talk a bit more about. There are stakeholders throughout the state of Michigan that rely heavily on the work that you do. And, when you think about what we are as a university and as the country's pioneer land-grant university, part of that land-grant university philosophy is applied research and taking what happens in the laboratory or on the laboratory bench and being able to translate that into making the lives of the residents of the state of Michigan better. And probably there's no better example of that than the work that you do in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. And I think about a trip that I made several years ago up to our extension station in our experiment station up in Traverse City. And they walked us through how they were working with the cherry community up there to try and eradicate a bug that really could cause the cherry crops great damage. And it's that kind of work, whether it's in developing tools and techniques, whether they're pesticides or other tools to keep our plants and fruits and vegetables safe. Or when disease hits our animal herds and the impact that could have on our population and our food sources. And so your outreach, and if we were in a business school, we'd call it return on investment, the great investment that the state of Michigan makes in Michigan State University, and how we as a university return that investment to the state in so many ways. And as I said, I think one of the best examples is what happens in your college. Could you share a little bit of that story with us?
Michigan's a really agriculturally diverse state. We produce well over 300 food and fiber products, and we're second only to California in terms of the number of products that we produce. But of course, we have a much smaller land area. But we're able to do that because of all the climatic diversity we have in the state and then the geologic diversity in our soils. And so you mentioned our Northwest Research Station Bill up in Traverse City, and that's co-located where we grow cherries, obviously, but also increasing amounts of wine grapes and apples and other sort of things. We have 15 such facilities distributed around the state, including two in the Upper Peninsula. And so, you know, in the Thumb area, we have a facility north of Frankenmuth, and that's, of course, a part of the state where we grow a lot of dry beans and beets and other important crops. And those are the things that we work on there. And the climatic diversity in the state and the geologic diversity means that we grow different things all around the state, and we're present with our partners there.
Yeah, that's it. Really is amazing how we can have a cherry crop up north and blueberries and then sugar beets and such a diverse range of crops, and given the climate and the the soil, and how we assist the state with all of that. I'm close to a number of turkey producers on the west side of the state, mm-hmm. And they rave about the work that the university does, both in your college and the College of Veterinary Medicine, to assist them with issues that come up and as they you know, as they work their turkey farm, essentially.
Yep.
So, Ron, you referenced an international presence, and I think sometimes people think of Michigan State as a place that serves the state of Michigan, but increasingly that footprint is international. Could you tell us a little bit of about the work that the college does around the world?
Yeah, well, I don't think you'd be surprised to know that a lot of our work's focused on food security. You know, Michigan State, along with just a couple other universities, really sort of are the biggest partners for many countries in Africa. And so we work with local farmers and farmer cooperatives. We work with federal and regional governments and those agencies. And our work is focused on things related to policy. You know, you have to have markets in which both producers and purchasers can have trust. It's about helping processors and building up those facilities so that you have value-added products in country. It's about helping farmers, you know, both from a subsistence standpoint and also, you know, smallholders and from a commercial standpoint. I mean, food security is fundamental to everything else. It's fundamental to economic security and national security. And so, you know, we have changed the lives literally of millions of people around the world, and particularly proud of the work that we and others have done in Africa and continue to do today. But we're working in Asia as well. We have partners in Europe, Central and South America, and, you know, focus mostly on things related to food, but also the natural environment, another real strength of ours. We have, you know, you go to places, parts of the world that are very remote. And you mentioned Michigan State University, and people know who we are. We have a very strong reputation. We're seen as a trusted partner. We're seen as people who work with, you know, we understand the importance of going into local communities and even in households and respecting people and customs and other things, and that we're not there to tell how. We're there to help learn together and to help show how where we can. But it's really all about making people self-sufficient from a nutritional standpoint and more so from an economic standpoint. And, you know, Michigan State, we've had international students on this campus, Bill, for over 100 years, very early in that respect. And, you know, people talk about our brand, you know, and that name, Michigan State University, means something, but it's less about the brand, and I think more about the positive impact we've had in so many places around the world and continue to have today. And a real point of pride of Michigan State that, as you said, I think a lot of people probably aren't aware of.
Yeah, no, there's that old British saying that the sun never sets on the British Empire. But when you think about the expanse of Michigan State and its influence around the world, you could really say the same thing. I've always made a point when I travel either domestically or internationally to wear a ball cap or a windbreaker or something with the Spartan logo on it. And it's always amazing to me whether you're walking through a city in Vietnam or London or, you know, or someplace in Louisiana. It's amazing how if you're sporting your apparel, you'll get a Go Green shout out before the day is through, almost no matter where you are in the world.
Yeah, very true. We, you know, we have those connections every place. We have those alums all over, and, you know, throughout the pandemic, it's, you know, I've talked about the three R's for our college, and, you know, we have a lot of talent, a lot of expertise on campus, but externally, you know, we have our reputation. We have those relationships, and we have that reach, that global reach. And those are things on which we've been able to build, but things that have also helped sustain us in particular over the last 9 or 10 months.
In the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, there are probably a larger percentage of classes that are really more hands-on focused, whether it's interacting with our crops and our the acres of research land that we have, or interacting with animals in those agriculture-related fields in your college, or laboratory courses in other scientific disciplines. And so, you know, one can imagine that if you were teaching a literature course, for example, in the College of Arts and Letters, it would be not too hard to take that online. On the other hand, in those courses that are really stuff intensive, that require more of a hands-on approach, it would seem more challenging to take those online. So how has the college cleared that hurdle and worked through that set of issues with a curriculum that probably is more hands-on than most?
Yeah, that's certainly been a big lift for our teaching faculty. And I think, Bill, with everyone else across the university in the springtime, we made that quick pivot, and there was certainly a lot of improvising going on. But the faculty prepared over the summer. The university put on training programs, week-long programs for faculty. And I had over 200 faculty in the college that participated in those to learn how to create content to deliver online, not knowing exactly what fall would hold. And so we've been able to, as we've been in some of our other things, a lot more use of video. You know, I know I've seen video of some of our animal science faculty, and rather than taking the students physically through the barn with them, they and the teaching assistants have moved them in a virtual way through the farms and, you know, and through the handling of animals and other sort of things. But some of that hands-on work still had to be done. So, you know, in forestry, we had our faculty members who teach some of our field experience courses, packing up equipment and some instructions, and then mailing that off to students, and then sitting with the students, showing them how to learn things. And instead of going to work in a public woodland or forest somewhere, they found local areas. Our parks and recreation students, they for their some of their projects, they took on local parks, you know, rather than working in a campus area or somewhere in Lansing or East Lansing area. So for some of those students, you know, they got the hands-on experience, and they were also immersed more in the local environment. And I know some of them reported back, it really meant a lot to them to be able to do projects and to be able to work and feel they were learning about or maybe helping with something close to home. And so, you know, we've had other faculty doing that well, shipping things out and, you know, spending a lot of extra time, as have the students, but to try and replicate to the extent possible those experiences. And as I think all of us, learning what we can do better through these as well. And what certainly certain things can't be done as well, or as to the extent we would like remote, but other things can. And so as we move back, you know, I think finding what's the proper blend of the hands-on and the distance or remote learning, you know, that's going to be the balance for us. And that'll take a while to figure out. But, you know, the faculty have been very ingenious about that, and the students have been very engaged and very accommodating.
Well, and I think that's maybe an example of how we figure out how to make lemonade out of this lemon that has been COVID. And thinking through some of the lessons learned and the your example of students working locally with parks in their area and the and how that's so rewarding. There are some things probably that we've done that have caused light bulbs to go off over people's heads and having aha moments of that's something to incorporate into the curriculum, or that's an idea that's worth continuing. And so that's, I think, really a testament to the creativity and vision of the faculty in thinking through how those, first how to adapt to that change. Yep. And then how to really, you know, try and make the most of it. And are there opportunities in all of this to drive forward and push ahead and do things maybe a little differently, a little more creatively, out of necessity, and then taking those kernels and pearls of wisdom that are learned and applying those as we go forward to make the curriculum better. And that's, to me, that's really exciting. So we've got faculty that teach our courses, but those same people and others also engage in research. And I know that the pandemic has affected our research faculty. In some cases we've had our faculty, really make a difference in applying what they know to the pandemic and becoming part of the solution. One example I found really fascinating, although I think there probably are others, was Joan Rose, one of our really internationally recognized water researchers, and the work that she did to help with COVID. Could you share a little bit of that story with us?
Yeah, Joan's work, has been really looking at tracing the virus in wastewater. And, we shed the virus in a variety of ways, but through human waste is one of those. And by monitoring wastewater, sewage, basically, you can track the virus, the abundance of the virus. And by knowing where it enters into the wastewater system, you can help identify where it's originating geographically. And so in terms of being able to predict outbreaks, you can be shedding the virus before you might be showing symptoms or being even asymptomatic. And so it's one way of sort of indirectly testing to find those areas and those populations, those communities or neighborhoods where people might be at risk. And, St. Joe's has been very instrumental in doing that work and working with the state and with others. Faculty member of mine, Jade Mitchell, has been, really sort of tag teaming with Joan, and Jade looks at risk management and risk behaviors and those sort of things. And so we have faculty building on their expertise with one another. Dr. Laura Bix is one of my packaging faculty members and administrator, and her specialty is medical packaging. So she's been really instrumental in helping the university in our spit testing program. Because Laura knows how those things have to be put together and how you have to handle, sample cups and other things so you don't get contamination and both the, so things are simple and straightforward for people to use. So there's been a lot of ways that the faculty have been engaged. And I think the other, area, Bill, we've seen is around the food system. And we've seen vulnerabilities in the supply chain. And particularly a couple of my agricultural economics faculty, their expertise is in this area. And so they've been prominent, not just here within the state, helping our producers and our farmers and our processors, but in the national news and functioning as resources for people in other places as well. And it's gratifying because we know the work that we do is important on a day-to-day basis. And, you and the other here at the university know that. But when our faculty and those in other colleges can contribute in material ways to, people who are suffering or scientists and health officials who are trying to track disease, it just adds one more layer of gratification to the things that we do.
Yeah, you mentioned Laura Bix, and I distinctly remember the first time I went over to the small building behind my office and picked up a Spartan spit test and walked back to my office and put the little box on my desk and read the instructions. And I think I read the instructions twice to make sure I wasn't goofing it up. And I remember thinking to myself, this is really cool. I mean, how it's designed. And I've also sort of been a fan of design, but how it's designed to put the little tubes in the top of the box and it walks you through it in a really clear and thoughtful way and makes sure that you don't goof it up. And I didn't realize until now that Laura had designed that, but it's those things that maybe seemingly pass in the moments of your everyday existence that you wouldn't think that, somebody you don't necessarily at least intuitively dive into how that product came to be. And And I think that's one of the more interesting areas of your college that most universities don't have is a school of packaging. And sometimes when we talk about it, people scratch their heads and say, you know, what is packaging? And yet, I think every person I've known that's graduated from the college, from the school of packaging, has found a good job. And it seems like it's an area where there's great need. So that's just such a unique area of your college that isn't found in many other places. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we are the first packaging program in the U.S. and it came about post-World War II and really was an amalgamation of some different disciplines, folks working in chemistry and in wood and paper science and formed the school. And we remain the only PhD granting program in the U.S. So a lot of the packaging science that's done not just here, but around the world is done by MSU graduates. And our graduates are in very high demand. Most of them end up with multiple job offers. And, as we try and build capacity, we'll be able to put out more students. But you're right, we don't often think about the packaging. I mean, we are all sort of have that mental struggle with, the physical struggle with the bag of cereal, right? Knowing it needs to be tightly closed to remain fresh, but you know, cursing at it as we try and get it open without spilling our Cheerios all over the place. But those things are replicated in other places. Laura's work, for example, in medical packaging, they use the same packaging for most medical supplies in the ER that they use in the ambulance. In the ER, you've got an environment with a lot of help, very sterile, but on the back of an ambulance, you might have one or maybe two MTs and they're bouncing around, and so you don't have nice sterile places and tables and a lot of help. So, being able to open a package in a moving ambulance where you don't have to use your teeth, for example, because you're the only one there, that's the sort of thing that Laura is working on. Making it better for patients, making it better for first responders and others. And that kind of work happens throughout the packaging school. It's making sure that things remain shelf stable. It's about, doing what we can to foster biodegradable packaging, so we're not taking up so much space and for such long periods of time in landfills. And it touches us in all parts of our lives in ways obvious and not so obvious. But it's heartening to hear you talk about your experiencing with that packaging. Something that's new for us, very different than opening the cereal box and knowing you had instructions and a clear way to do it, in a way that you felt you were going to get a sample there and get back some useful information. Super important in everyday life and particularly now during the pandemic.
Well, somebody said life is in the details, and I think that so much that's going on in the college is in the details, and sometimes they're not always noticeable or things that we intuitively think about, like packaging, but the ways in which they make our world a better place are really innumerable. And thinking about the hypothetical of being in the back of the ambulance and how critical it is that you can immediately access supplies, and yet those supplies have to be in a sterile environment, and the processes that it takes to solve those questions, and that researchers and go through trial and error and testing and working with our students to solve those problems that so many of which we just take for granted, really, I think, is a microcosm of what you do in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, solving so many of the world's problems that we're so grateful for, and yet that we just sort of take for granted in our daily life. That when we go to Meijer's and we have a selection of 10 different apples to buy, that each and every one of them is healthy and safe and isn't going to cause us a disease, and that our food supply is secure and all of those incredible things. So, Ron, we've talked about a lot of weighty issues, and I always like to end with with at least a question or two that's on the less weighty side. So I'll ask you, when you're not doing the extraordinary work of managing this this comprehensive operation that we call the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, what do you do for fun?
Well, you know, that's been a little harder to find lately, and certainly some of the things we like to do are a little bit more difficult. So my wife and I enjoy traveling. That's, you know, something we're a little more constrained now. We've tried to make use of the opportunities we do have to look around locally, you know, around the state. We're both from Michigan, so the parts of the state we know very well and other parts that we don't. You know, getting outside a lot, you know, my background academically is in forestry, and that sprang out of a lot of my interest in the outdoors and time I spent there. So this has been a great time to be able to get outside. You know, we need the fresh air, we need the sunshine, we need the exercise. And so, you know, just getting out and about, doing almost anything are helpful. It seems if I'm at home, I'm usually work finds me somehow. So I think all those relaxing things are necessarily mean I'm doing something somewhere else.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Our guest has been Ron Hendrick, a Dean of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Michigan State University, solving so many of the world's problems in ways obvious and in many cases less so, and fulfilling our land grant mission as the pioneer land grant university each and every day. So Ron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it. Always good to be with you. Thanks.